He looked at Storm, but his attention was on the stranger, whom he could see out of the corner of his eye. The stranger was staring at the floor between them. He didn't appear threatening, necessarily, but still it was the sort of situation Fowler liked to avoid.
"Why do those women look like me?" Storm asked. "They look exactly like me."
"It's just like the woman in your world who looked like my friend, Orchid. Maybe we all have twins." The stranger looked at them, then at his fingernails, one of which was missing.
"We must be sisters."
"Maybe." Fowler gestured toward the stranger. Storm shrugged. It was beginning to border on absurd to be in such a small space with someone and not speak to him. Before he realized what was happening, Storm was standing over the stranger. She cleared her throat. The man looked up. He had remarkably sharp cheekbones and bright, angry eyes.
"I thought I should introduce myself, since it seems we're going to be roommates."
Storm stuck out her hand.
"My name is Storm."
The stranger studied her.
"I don't understand. Why did you change your name?"
"No, I'm not..."
Storm pointed vaguely. "I'm not one of the women you know, the twins."
"You just look exactly like them?" the man asked.
"That's right."
The stranger looked at Storm for a long moment.
"Do you think I'm stupid?"
"No," Storm began.
"No, honestly, she's telling the truth,"
Fowler said. He tried to insert himself between the man and Storm, but Storm wouldn't give ground, so he ended up beside her.
"I know it sounds absurd, but honestly, if we were going to lie to you, wouldn't we choose something more believable?"
The man studied Fowler, his face unreadable.
"I mean, look at our situation."
Fowler swept a hand to indicate the cell.
"We're in a small, locked space with a stranger who can clearly snap both of our necks without bothering to stand. Why in the world would we agitate you?"
The big man considered this.
"I'm Fowler, by the way."
Fowler offered his hand. After a pause, the man reached up and shook.
"Snakebite!"
The man's hand was so big, Fowler felt like a child shaking a grown-up's hand.
"Snakebite? That's an interesting name," Storm said. "How'd you get it?"
Snakebite rolled up his pant leg, exposing yet another scar, this one two puckered holes set about an inch apart.
"I was bit by a snake."
He looked up at Fowler and Storm. A smile broke across his face. Fowler and Storm burst into laughter. Snakebite rolled down his pant leg.
"I heard you say everyone has twins on other worlds. What did you mean?"
Fowler decided to take it more slowly this time. He retrieved his pack, pulled out the parachute, and explained it to Snakebite, who examined the chute carefully, right down to the clasps and harness. Only then did he and Storm explain exactly what they'd used the chute for, as shock and alarm grew increasingly apparent on Snakebite's face.
"Shit,"
Snakebite said when they'd finished.
"You believe us,"
Fowler said, trying not to sound surprised.
"Why wouldn't I? You're here, aren't you?"
The outer door squealed open. The twins, who looked like Storm, were led in by Stuart.
"Now I'm trusting you to watch your mouth. Keep the conversation civil,"
Stuart said, wagging a finger at Fowler. Fowler nodded, confused as to why he was being singled out as a potential potty mouth.
"I'm Susanna,"
one of the twins said to Storm as the outer door closed. She pointed to her sister.
"This is Emily." "I'm Storm."
A tear welled under her eye and broke down her cheek.
"Are we sisters?"
Susanna stepped closer, grasped the bars.
"We must be."
Storm swallowed, not in agreement. She moved closer to the twins, clutched the bars. Fowler wasn't convinced it was that simple, given that Orchid also seemed to have a sister on a different world, but he kept his mouth shut because he didn't have a better explanation.
"We're going to get you out of there right now. This is ridiculous," Emily said. "I think Stuart is due for a good kick in the nuts," Susanna added.
Fowler grinned. Maybe they were sisters. They struggled for what to say to each other. Emily finally asked,
"Where are you from?"
Storm stammered, seeking an answer, finally gave up.
"I'll explain when we have more time."
Susanna and Emily promised to return with a mob to string Stuart up if necessary. Snakebite waited until the door had closed completely, then, in a low voice, asked,
"So what is this other world like?"
"Worlds. There are at least two others." They described their worlds while Snakebite listened intently. Storm and Faller began to pepper in questions of their own, though Snakebite was clearly more at ease listening than speaking.
"There were pigs, cows, crops in the ground when we woke," Snakebite said when Storm asked him about day one. "People were hungry, and there was some killing, but most people were just scared and confused. It was when things settled down that it started getting strange here."
"Strange how?"
Storm prompted, when it seemed Snakebite wasn't going to elaborate.
"Everyone started pretending it never happened. If you brought up those early days, people acted like they couldn't hear you. They talk about making others feel bad, which means talking about the early days. Now no one ever asks out loud what telephones are for, why some of us were born young and others old."
Storm looked at Faller, "Which explains what we're doing in here." Turning back to Snakebite, she asked, "Is that why you're in here too? For talking about the early days?"
"Me? No," Snakebite said. "I know better than to disturb their little fantasy world. I'm in here because I won't apologize for cutting off Wayne's fingers."
Faller conjured a gruesome image of Snakebite pinning some poor guy's hand to a table and slicing off his fingers one by one. But the truth was less sinister. Wayne and three of his brothers had gone to Snakebite's place because Snakebite was using more water from a community trough than the brothers were happy with. Words were exchanged, and a fight broke out. Wayne went for a scythe, leaned up against the wall in Snakebite's workshop, but grabbed it by the blade. When Snakebite kicked it out of his reach, Wayne's fingers went with it. The city council thought Snakebite should apologize. Snakebite disagreed. When the door opened a second time, Stuart was holding a key. Behind him, Susanna and Emily bore expressions of profound self-satisfaction.
"The city council is assembling."
Stuart unlocked the cell, and Storm and Faller filed out. Snakebite put his hands on his thighs and climbed to his feet.
"I guess I'm ready to come out as well. You're ready to apologize to Wayne?"
"I guess so."
Snakebite struggled to look sincere.
"Come on, then."
Stuart swung the cell door wide and led them outside. Chapter 26. Faller was famished, but he kept his mouth shut, afraid to violate any other neurotic, unspoken rules of this world he didn't know about. The meeting hall was a big, high-ceilinged church with stained glass windows depicting people herding sheep, looking down at babies, kneeling before people with circles of light around their heads. Halos. There was nothing Faller couldn't find a word for. On Faller's world, churches were mostly abandoned. The windows knocked out, the space wasn't useful for anything, and although people had a vague idea that churches were for talking to gods, nobody knew exactly what you were supposed to say and how to confirm they were listening. Stuart escorted Storm and Faller to the front row and told them to wait. He hurried off to join one of the clusters of people forming in the back, speaking in hushed tones and glancing at Faller and Storm. Faller was opening his mouth to tell Storm how uncomfortable the stairs were making him, when Orchid walked in.
"Oh, you've got to be kidding me," Faller said.
She was cradling a baby wrapped in a white blanket. Her blue jeans, free of mending or patches, rolled at the cuff to accommodate her small size. Her boots were in similar fresh-from-the-box condition. She was with a tall, white-haired, smarmy-looking man wearing wire-rimmed glasses. They were speaking to Stuart, and by the way Stuart was bending at the waist, Faller could tell Orchid's companion was someone important.
"What? Who are you looking at?"
Storm was scanning the back of the room when suddenly she inhaled sharply.
"Wait a minute, that's
Orchid. Again." Faller squeezed past Storm into the aisle. "I'll be right back." Storm grabbed his arm.
"Are you sure that's a good idea?"
Faller shrugged. "What's the harm? I'm sure she won't know me. I'm curious to see how similar she is to the Orchid I know." As he approached, he watched for Orchid's reaction, and while she stared at him with wide-eyed curiosity and perhaps a tinge of fear, it didn't look as if she recognized him. She whispered something to her companion, who was still talking to Stuart. The tall man turned to look at Faller. His eyes, mouth,
Even his nostrils opened wide, and he shouted a primordial, lung-emptying, "Ha!" as he stumbled backward. Hawk had caught him, otherwise he might have fallen right through the open front doors. The room went silent. All eyes turned to the white-haired man, who was breathing heavily, trying to compose himself, but still gawking at Fowler like he was a giant hairy spider or something. The reaction left Fowler stunned and confused. This man recognized him. Fowler crossed the silent room and held out his hand. "I get the sense you know me, but I can't seem to place you." He said it loud enough that everyone in the room could hear. The man looked at Fowler's hand. His nose wrinkled as if there were a bad smell in the room.
"What? No."
He took a half step back, still not reaching to shake Fowler's hand.
"Of course I don't know you. Who are you?"
"My name is Fowler." He grasped the man's wrist with his left hand, drew the hand into his own, maintaining eye contact.
"And you are?"
The man's palm was greased with sweat.
"My name is Bruce, Vice Deputy of the City Council."
The mention of credentials was a transparent attempt to regain the upper hand Bruce was clearly used to holding. But Fowler wasn't intimidated. Maybe it was Bruce's reaction to him, or maybe having Storm at his side gave him confidence.
"A pleasure to meet you."
Fowler tried to read the man's bird-like eyes. Bruce disengaged his hand and, straightening a worn but clean corduroy jacket, headed toward the dais. Orchid's double, actually it was triple now, followed after a final glance at Fowler. When Fowler returned to his row, the twins were seated beside Storm. Snakebite was in the row behind them. Fowler's head was spinning, trying to assimilate the perplexing details that had just been added to his understanding of the universe. There were at least three Orchids and three Storms. Had each world somehow started out comprised of the same people? If that were the case, the snakebite on his world had died early on, because if Fowler had ever laid eyes on snakebite before, he would remember. And of course, he was quite certain there had been no Storm on his world. As he scanned the faces in the room, none besides Orchids was familiar, and Fowler was certain he'd met every person on his world at least a handful of times. For that matter, no one on Storm's world had looked familiar to him save for Storm and the other Orchid. So a few people had duplicates, others not. People were settling into their seats. The meeting was about to start. Fowler had no idea how they should navigate this. He twisted in his seat to face Snakebite. "Any advice on how to handle this?" Snakebite leaned in so his mouth was close to Fowler's ear. Storm leaned toward Fowler so she could hear the exchange.
"Lie,"
Snakebite said.
"Lie? Come up with an explanation that doesn't make anyone feel bad. Give them half a chance and they'll happily shove their heads back into their asses and pretend you've always been here."
Fowler nodded slowly, wondering what possible explanation he could offer other than the truth. On the dais, a black-haired man with thick eyebrows called the meeting to order by banging two small sticks together over his head. Fowler closed his eyes, trying to think. He needed something.
"My name is Carl. This here is Danny."
He went on to name the other seven men lined up in their folding chairs, then kept right on going, naming everyone in the room, maybe 100 people, before asking Fowler and Storm their names.
"I guess what we need to know is,"
Carl turned his palms up,
"where have you been? Why don't we know you?"
Fowler looked at Storm. All Fowler had thought of was, "We've been hiding from you intentionally." It wasn't much of an explanation, and when Carl asked why they'd been hiding, he wouldn't have an answer. Still looking at Fowler, Storm said,
"We don't know."
"What do you mean you don't know?"
Carl asked. The answer had caught Fowler off guard. How was "we don't know" going to get them off the hook and out of this weird gathering? Storm sobbed, buried her face in her hands. Fowler patted her back and made soothing sounds, wondering what the hell she was up to.
"One moment we were just there, in that field. I don't know who I am, where I came from. I can't remember anything except my name."
A buzz went through the room. Fowler glanced around, unsure whether Storm's admission constituted spreading bad feelings. From their expressions, no one else was either. Storm wasn't talking about day one. She was just alluding to it enough to make everyone uncomfortable and hopefully sympathetic. The members of the city council were conversing,
the men in the chairs on the ends stretching toward the center to hear and be heard. Fowler glanced back at Snakebite, who raised his eyebrows and shrugged. Apparently he had no idea how it would play. Suddenly, Emily and Susanna were on the dais as well, leaning into the conversation. Fowler heard Carl tell them to go sit down, but the sisters went right on talking. He couldn't catch their words in the general din of conversation, but their tone was insistent. Bruce was also doing a lot of talking, his eyebrows pinched, his voice just as pinched. He went back and forth with Carl, the sisters, and some of the others until Carl said something sharp and clipped, and the conversation came to an abrupt halt. Carl clicked the sticks together until the buzz in the room died down.
There are things in the world that are unknowable.
He looked at Fowler and Storm.
We can't hold that against you. As long as you keep your speech civil,
he looked pointedly at Fowler,
we don't see any need to discuss this further.
These were strange people. Fowler rose from his seat along with everyone else, watching Bruce, who was watching him. The crowd was pressed tightly together as they headed toward the exits, but a buffer of space, an invisible circle an arm's length in diameter, surrounded Fowler and the three Storms. It was unsettling to see them so close together, like there was something wrong with his vision.
Can I talk to you for a minute?
Storm asked, as they climbed down the church's front steps. She grasped his wrist, led him a few paces down the street.
Susanna and Emily invited me to stay with them for now, and I told them I would.
Fowler tried to mask the sting he felt. He'd assumed they'd stick together, because of the photo, the secret they shared.
I understand you're angry at me. It has nothing to do with that.
Okay, Fowler said, realizing he'd been silent for too long.
But let's talk soon.
Storm nodded.
I think that's a good idea.
She rejoined her twins and headed off toward their home, wherever that was. Fowler felt utterly lost and deflated without her. He checked the sky. It was late afternoon. The thought of wandering around until he found an abandoned house to sleep in, alone, under dusty sheets, depressed the hell out of him. He spotted Snakebite, halfway down the street.
Snakebite?
The big man waited while Fowler caught up.
I don't have anywhere to stay.
He paused, hoping Snakebite would jump in with an invitation. But Snakebite only waited.
Can I stay with you?
Snakebite nodded.
Come on.
They didn't speak as they walked, and Fowler was grateful for the silence. He needed time to think. He wondered about Bruce. What would cause that sort of reaction from a grown man? Fowler's presence had shocked Bruce, like he'd seen a ghost. What if Fowler had once had a double on this world and Bruce had seen him die? That would explain a lot, actually. Bruce wouldn't be able to account for his reaction without referring to the early days, so he'd be forced to deny he recognized Fowler. What if Bruce had killed Fowler's double in the early days? That would explain the bald shock on Bruce's face. Imagine coming face to face with a man you killed.
Why are you smiling?
Snakebite asked. Fowler hadn't realized he was. I'm trying to figure out why Bruce was so startled when he saw me.
If something like that can make you smile, you must be a happy man.
Fowler laughed, shook his head. I'm just thinking crazy thoughts. Turning onto the main street, they passed beneath storefront canopies, late afternoon sunshine alternating with blue shade. Despite the chipping paint, the stores were beautiful in their way, each a different color, each with a distinct face.
Bruce is an important man, Snakebite said. He got his position because he figured out things in the early days that kept people alive.
Like what?
Snakebite shrugged.
How to pump water from the ground? How to keep the crops growing? What some of the medicines did?
How did he know those things?
I don't know. He figured it out.
Do you like him?
Fowler asked. Snakebite looked at him, apparently annoyed by the question.
I don't like anyone. I'd just as soon live in the woods on the other end of the world.
Then why don't you?
Because I like to eat.
Snakebite lived above one of the stores
that hung over the edge, in an apartment with small rooms and narrow hallways. He invited Fowler to choose either of the spare rooms with a bed. Fowler chose the one with a window overlooking the edge. Then, to Fowler's surprise and delight, offered him a meal. The kitchen was on the ground floor behind the store, and it, like the store, was filled with broken things. Snakebutt explained that he earned his food fixing things, shoes, chairs, brushes, bicycles, anything people brought him. "How did you learn to fix so many things?" Fowler asked as he watched Snakebite pull a rabbit off a hook in the pantry. His heart began to thud, his mouth water with anticipation. Snakebite seemed confused by the question.
"I didn't. I study each thing as it comes and I figure it out."
He set the rabbit on a cutting board.
"It's just common sense."
"I think you've bought into your world's discomfort with the past more than you realize." Snakebite seemed startled by the observation.
"How's that?"
"I can't tell you how many times I saw someone in my world pick up a flute or darning needles and their fingers knew just what to do, even if they didn't." Fowler held up a hand. "Yet my fingers won't play a flute." Clutching the rabbit in one hand, a knife in the other, Snakebite considered.
"You're saying I learned how to fix things before the first days?"
"That's what I'm saying. Did you wake here in this house on day one? With all of these tools and things?" Snakebite made a long slice across the rabbit's back, then set the knife down, grasped the rabbit in both hands, and peeled the skin back in both directions.
"No, I was in a cemetery, behind the church where the meeting was held. I was sitting with my back against a headstone."
Fowler nodded. Snakebite was like him, born homeless. Fowler had envied the people in his world who woke on day one in a house, with people around them, photos nearby that suggested they meant something to each other before day one. Snakebite glanced up at him.
"What do you think happened?"
"I don't know, but I think I will by the time I reach the bottom." Fowler pulled out his map, smoothed it on the table so Snakebite could see it. "I drew this for myself, with my own blood, before day one." Fowler's bedroom was littered with useless day one things, as if Snakebite had never bothered to change anything. Colorful posters covered the walls, a human skull with three men's faces peering out the eye and nose holes, a winged woman rendered in a red so bright it seared Fowler's vision. Small plastic replicas of cars, airplanes, ships were displayed on a shelf. There was a stack of comic books on a bedside table. Fowler grabbed the stack, sat on the edge of the bed, and thumbed through them. They were mostly cartoon animals, not his favorites. On his world, he'd looked at comic books now and then. Eventually, he'd caught on that the pictures weren't random like in the art gallery. They told a story if you looked at them in the right order, which was always left to right and down the page. Toward the bottom of the stack, Fowler came upon one that wasn't cartoon animals, and as he pulled it from the stack, he laughed with delight because he recognized it. Once, on his own world, he looked through the exact same comic. The man on the cover was wearing a tight blue and yellow costume that reminded Fowler of his own jumpsuit. Maybe it had been the inspiration for Fowler's costume, though he didn't recall thinking about the comic while choosing his outfit. Fowler paged through the comic like it was an old friend. It wasn't surprising, really, to find the exact same comic on this world. Many of the cars were the same, even some of the people, so why not the same comic books? When he'd finished reminiscing, Fowler dragged the bed under the open window. Lying on his back with his hands propping his head, he gazed out at the bright swirl of stars as a cool breeze washed over him. He wondered how many worlds were out there, seeding that endless sky. He withdrew the map from his pocket, counted the ovals. According to his map, there were seven. Maybe there were seven, but if there were 1,000, he wouldn't have had enough paper or blood to draw them all, so the map might not be representative. For all he knew, there were 1,000,000 worlds. Were there more worlds to the sides as well as below? Maybe, more importantly, was there anyone out there who could tell him why things seemed to have started in the middle, why the worlds were peppered with the same people? Someone, somewhere, must have answers. Fowler stared at the X over the bottom world. He was betting the answers
were down there.
Chapter 13. They stared at the TV mounted on the factory wall in disbelief. On MSNBC, soldiers were swarming up Market Street in San Francisco. Foreign soldiers, Russian, Venezuelan, maybe North Korean farther down the coast. Foreign soldiers were invading. Russian T-90 tanks were on the beach in Santa Monica, firing on U.S. positions in the city. Peter felt a hand on his shoulder, turned to find Harry beside him, stone-faced.
"I think we have to bring more people into the fold. We need to move faster."
"The power stations are going to be the holdup."
They had 200 engineers working on the nanostructured fuel cells, three entire factories in the process of being converted to produce the cells. None of those employees knew why they were designing what they were designing, building what they were building.
"Then we need to put more people on that end of it."
It had never occurred to Peter that the Western Alliance might lose. Peter hadn't wanted either side to win. He wanted it to end in a draw, the war called on account of pointlessness.
"You're right."
He squeezed his temples, trying to banish the relentless headache. It was always with him. No wonder, given how little sleep he was getting. His eyelids, his fingers were twitching with exhaustion.
"I've got to get back to work."
Peter turned toward the station set up in the corner, stumbled, dropped to his knees. A loud buzzing hit his ears as his vision went dark.
"Peter?" "Yeah, I'm all right."
Peter struggled to his hands and knees. He'd fainted. He hadn't even realized he'd lost consciousness. It had come over him like a wave. He felt a hand grasp him under the arm.
"Take it easy. Sit. Just sit."
The feet and legs of his colleagues were all around him as he sat on the floor, still woozy.
"Call an ambulance," Harry said to someone.
"No, a trip to the emergency room will eat half a day. It's just fatigue. Peter, you just passed out. We gotta get you looked at."
Peter took a deep breath, trying to clear his head. It was pounding, and he had chills rushing through him that felt like an electric current.
"What do we have, 3 MDs on the payroll? Get one of them down here."
10 minutes earlier, he'd silently vowed to rest for 5 more minutes, then get back to work. There seemed to be extra gravity holding him down, pressing him into the cot. It was an effort to lift his arm to reach for the water Dr. Otero had left for him. He had a headache in 2 distinct places behind his eyes and in the back on the left side of his head. No one could do his work for him, though. Maybe he should give in, sleep for 6 or 7 hours. Dr. Otero came in carrying a printout, likely the results of the blood test. She was wearing a mask. She hadn't worn a mask during the examination. "Dr. Sandoval," she paused. She looked deadly serious. Potential diseases ran through Peter's head, cancer, ALS. "You've contracted the Peterson-Jans prion." She dropped her gaze. "I'm so sorry." It felt as if the cot had been pulled out from beneath him and he was falling. He was sure he was about to lose consciousness again. Maybe he had lost consciousness and was imagining this whole scenario. He'd taken every precaution. Should have had a 0% chance of contracting the disease. It could only be passed through fluid, blood, semen, saliva. There was always room for error, wasn't there? He had a month at most. Most of it would not be quality time. A memory of Isabella twitching raced through his head like a spider scrabbling down his spine. The terror, the black, sinking terror really kicked in, doubling him over, making his vision swim and his head spin. He was going to die. "Do you want me to inform anyone for you?" Otero asked.
"No, don't tell anyone."
He needed to finish the project before he died.
"Did he have enough time?"
"No. You need to be hospitalized under quarantine."
"I'll check myself in."
He looked up at Otero, beseeching. "I've been carrying it unknowingly for days. If I were going to infect anyone, it wouldn't be now that I'm aware I have it. At least now I know not to share an ice cream cone with anyone." Dr. Otero nodded. "I'll leave you to rest and check on you in a few hours."
"Thanks."
As Otero's footsteps faded, Peter could hear work going on in the lab. He didn't see how they'd be able to finish the project without him.
They'd have to turn it over to the federal government, who would undoubtedly try to turn the singularity into a weapon. Maybe the diagnosis was a false positive. There must be cases where they misdiagnosed. Peter laughed out loud. Here we go, denial. The first stage in Kubler-Ross's stages of dying. Next, he started bargaining, although with whom, he had no idea. Maybe he could bargain with Ugo. If you'll resume your work on Peterson-Jantz, find a way to isolate the prion-binding properties without the side effect of the complete obliteration of my memory, He'd what? Bring Isabella back? Ugo despised him. Maybe Ugo had a right to despise him. His thoughts kept turning back to Isabella. She'd asked him to try to imagine what it felt like to be dying. He'd done his best, now he knew his imaginings were a pale shadow of what it actually felt like. You simply couldn't imagine what it felt like until someone was standing in front of you, holding your test results. And now that he felt the full weight of dying, Isabella's desire to be duplicated made perfect sense. He could do it, now that he knew he had to be unconscious when he went through. He could do it, if he wanted to. He was so close to tapping the power of the singularity, to ending the war before it consumed the planet. What about Melissa? If he did this, would the new Peter simply pick up where the old Peter left off? When the old Peter died, did they start again from the beginning? Was he really considering this? Considering, yes. Ugo would despise Peter even more if Peter succeeded in duplicating himself after failing with Isabella. Would anyone understand? Would his duplicate be allowed to carry on, to inherit Peter's lab, his grants? Or would he be whisked off to some CIA lab for study? He'd have to do it secretly, in the middle of the night, just like with Isabella. This ends Disc 5. Fowler, Disc 6. Chapter 27. As soon as the sun rose, Fowler wanted a fine storm, but that would seem needy and pathetic. He might well be needy and pathetic, but he didn't want to seem that way to Storm. Instead, he took out the photo. It was badly worn around the edges, the corners rounded, but Storm's smiling face was still crystal clear. Then it dawned on him. Maybe Susanna and Emily's attire, the country dresses, their hair in identical yellow bows, had thrown him because it was so different from the black blouse and jeans the Storm in his photo was wearing. Storm must have also realized by now that she might not be the woman in the photo. Maybe that was why she'd chosen to go with her twins rather than stick with Fowler. He didn't want to believe either Susanna or Emily was the woman in the photo. They might look like Storm. But there was something about Storm, a feeling he got when he was around her, that told him she was the one he'd once loved. The one he still loved. He felt sure his feelings for her had come through day one intact, even if it had stripped away everything else. How else could he explain the love he felt for this woman? He'd felt it from the moment he'd met her. She was beautiful, yes, but so was Orchid. So were a lot of women. They didn't make his stomach feel like he was falling when he was standing on solid ground. Only Storm did. Despite the heaviness of her absence, Fowler decided it was best to give her time, to let her come find him when she was ready. In the meantime, he helped Snakebite in any small way he could, holding two broken ends of an axe together while Snakebite set screws, finishing the stitching on a shoe once Snakebite had the pattern started. The first few times Fowler tried to make conversation, Snakebite only grunted or nodded. When Fowler persisted, Snakebite stopped what he was doing and glared at Fowler. "Pay attention." From then on, the only time either of them spoke was to say something necessary like, "Hand me that hammer." Around midday, they were working on a bicycle. The chain had snapped off, and Snakebite was replacing it with one he'd taken from a bike with no wheels propped in a corner of the store.
"One day there'll be no more spare parts, and then there'll be no more bicycles,"
Snakebite said as he threaded the chain through while Fowler slowly rotated a pedal. "It's safer to walk anyway," Fowler said. "My friend Stripe hit an open manhole riding a bike and lost his front teeth. Snakebite nodded.
Maybe you're right.
Fuller watched carefully to see how Snakebite linked the two ends of the chain together to create a loop.
What does it feel like to fall?
Snakebite asked, keeping his eyes on his work. The question took Fowler by surprise. At first it's bad. It feels like your heart is going to explode, like your stomach is falling faster than the rest of you. After a while, it's almost peaceful, like you're not falling at all. Snakebite wiped sweat from his forehead with the back of his wrist.
Do you twist and turn in the wind?
You can stabilize yourself by moving your arms and legs. He'd forgotten how difficult it was to imagine what it was like to fall. Snakebite gave the pedal a trial spin. The bike's back wheel clicked smoothly along. Unlocking the bike from the vise, Snakebite flipped it effortlessly to the floor and, clutching the handlebars, pushed it toward Fowler.
Would you deliver this to the owner? You can walk it. It's not far.
Fowler smiled. Sure. Where do I go?
It belongs to Bruce's wife. He pointed toward the street. A few blocks past the council hall, big yellow house on the left. You'll see it.
Snakebite held the front door open for him. As Fowler looked at him and nodded thanks, Snakebite kept his face even, betraying nothing. But Snakebite had to realize the opportunity he was giving Fowler with this errand. Wheeling the bike down the main street, Fowler passed a man sitting on the bumper of a red car, eating an onion right out in the open where anyone could run by and snatch it from him. Such an odd place. There was a silver figure of a running horse set in the center of the car's grill. Fowler wondered how these people could have cars lining the street, even sit on them, yet never talk about where they came from. Maybe they got it out of their systems late at night in bed, whispering their questions to their lovers. The doors to the shop he'd passed on the way into town were still open. He slowed, peered in. There were three people in the shop, one behind the counter, the other two looking at things on the shelves and laid out on the floor. They weren't talking to each other. On his world, people talked pretty much nonstop. Maybe it was a side effect of not being allowed to talk about day one. They didn't look back. And if you didn't look back, there wasn't much reason to talk except to ask someone to pass you a hammer or to ask why you've never seen them before in your life. Fowler passed the council hall as the road sloped downhill. He spotted Bruce's house, a grand affair with mown grass and not one broken window. As he turned the nose of the bike up the driveway, the front door burst open and Bruce surged out. He stopped short a few paces off the porch, retreated back inside, and reappeared, clutching a tire iron.
You're not welcome here, not ever,
Bruce said as he approached. You've never seen me before. You don't know anything about me, but you're out of your house with a tire iron when I show up with your bicycle? He liked this world. It was softer than his, and way softer than Storm's. Old men thought they could threaten younger ones with a metal stick.
Come on, cut the shit. How do you know me?
Bruce's Adam's apple bobbed.
I don't know you, but I know your type. You'll ruin this place if someone doesn't stop you.
Fowler noticed movement, saw Orchid's doppelganger watching from an upstairs window. He decided he liked the word doppelganger. As far as he remembered, it was the first time he'd ever thought it.
My type. You nearly jumped out of your shoes because you turned and saw me and recognized my type.
He let the words drip with sarcasm.
I got a Charlie horse, Bruce said. I turned wrong. It had nothing to do with you.
Fowler could see he wasn't going to get anything useful from this man. He kicked open the kickstand on the bike and turned away without a word. On Fowler's world, it was a dire insult to turn your back on a man holding a weapon. Fowler hoped it was on this world as well. Chapter 14. Peter set the head of the hazard suit down and turned away. He resisted the urge to double-check the doors to the lab. They were locked. He knew they were. Instead, he pulled off his sweatshirt, his hands trembling from exhaustion and his illness, dropped his pants and underpants and stepped out of them, set them in a crumpled heap on his desk next to the handgun. Steadying himself on the desk, he took a deep, whooshing breath, trying to muster the energy to do this. The worst part was not getting to say goodbye to Melissa. But he couldn't imagine her going along with this plan, and it was the only plan that made sense. Too many lives were at stake. The rungs of the short steel ladder were cold on the soles of his bare feet. He felt like a prisoner climbing a gallows. Stepping into the steel cage with the trapdoor floor he'd rigged, he stared down at the iris, so like a giant eye staring up at him. Now that he was above that hole, he wondered if he really had the nerve to inject the methohexital and fall into it. His hands were clamped to the cold steel of the cage, as if nothing could possibly budge them. This was the only way, though. Melissa wouldn't have to lose him. Millions of lives would be saved, all of this in exchange for a few months of pain-ridden life. He could have asked Harry to help him do this. He'd come close, but it wasn't fair to Harry. Peter could do it himself, and he'd already asked Harry to do more than any friend should ever have to do. Peter took a deep breath, engaged the timer for the trapdoor floor. It would open in 3 minutes. He slid the syringe out of the plastic tube into his palm and thought about Isabella, her pale, twitching body, the terror in her eyes. "I need you to look at me, Peter. Look at my eyes. I'm so scared." Twice he stabbed himself, only to have the needle jerk free of his flesh because of his trembling. He stabbed more firmly the third time, pushed the plunger down with the heel of his hand. Blackness enveloped him. He'd been dreaming, but the dreams already felt old and faded, like they'd happened to him as a child. He couldn't remember the dreams, but just the thought of them made his skin prickle and his balls shrivel. Peter opened his eyes. Rusty steel rafters crisscrossed far above. He turned his head. Another Peter was sitting on an identical wheeled gurney across from him, gathering his wits. Peter suddenly remembered that the plan was for him, the real Peter, to die now. For one irrational instant, he considered running. He laughed aloud. The other Peter looked up. "What?" Peter stood shakily. "For a minute I thought about running away from you, to escape my own carefully thought-out plan." The other Peter smiled. "You know what's even funnier?" "What?" The other Peter waited, giving Peter time to figure it out for himself, but Peter had no idea. "What's even funnier," the other Peter finally said, smiling wanly, "is that you don't even know which Peter you are." Peter looked at the layout of the lab, realized he was facing the wrong way. He was sitting below the wrong delivery duct. And he felt fine. No headache, no tremors. The other Peter, the real Peter, padded across the concrete floor and climbed into the chemical vat. It came to his neck. Peter remembered climbing into that vat a week ago, remembered the cold, awful, hopeless feeling it had given him to stand in it. Only, it hadn't been him. He'd only existed for 3 minutes. "Happy birthday." The pistol was lying on the corner of the desk where the other Peter had left it. For the 1,000th time, and the first, he wondered if a gun was the best way. But he'd gone over it and knew that, ugly and bloody as it was, a bullet to the brain was the least painful method given the situation. Peter hurried, aware that every moment of the real Peter's life was hell now. Time spent in a chemical vat waiting to die wasn't time worth having. The other Peter was hunched inside the vat, his face twitching in terror, his mouth pulled back in a tight grimace. He was squatting in the cylindrical vat, his head below the top to minimize the chance of getting blood or tissue on the floor. The inside of the vat had been coated in elastic tiles to prevent ricochet. Peter had thought of everything, except that he wasn't a killer. "I don't think I can do this." The gun felt like it weighed 50 pounds.
The other Peter looked up. Jesus, just get it over with.
I can't. We need to figure out another way.
His mind raced, seeking a way out.
We're identical twins, separated at birth. Don't make me do this myself,
the Peter in the vat said, his voice near hysterical.
That would be so much worse. I'm giving you my life. Just do this one thing for me, please.
His hand shaking, Peter pointed the pistol at the base of the other Peter's skull and aimed downward into the spinal column, as they'd planned.
Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, Peter, I can't shoot you in cold blood. I'm fucking dying anyway, just...
He jerked the trigger. The back of the other Peter's head exploded, and he collapsed into the vat. Peter squeezed his eyes shut and turned away.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
He was making a wheezy, keening sound and couldn't stop. He needed to pull himself together to get this finished. Then he could fall into the cot in the back office and have a complete breakdown. He could cry into a pillow or scream into a pillow and mourn himself. Peter started the flow of perchloric acid into the tank. While it filled, hissing and steaming, as it burned away the real Peter's body, he got dressed. When the tank had drained, he staggered to the cot, took both Xanax tablets he'd left on the night table, washed them down with a paper cup of water. He was Peter now, the one and only. No one else could ever know he wasn't the original. Not even Melissa. Chapter 28. The daylight had just begun to fade when Emily and Susanna came into Snakebite's shop, one of them carrying a three-legged chair, the other the fourth leg. While one consulted with Snakebite, the other set the broken leg on a table, then turned to Fowler.
It's me, Storm.
Even after she said her name, it took Fowler a moment to understand. She and Emily, or was it Susanna, were wearing identical paisley-patterned house dresses. Clearly, she'd bonded with her sisters. Fowler couldn't suppress a twinge of jealousy.
I can take care of this right now if you want to wait,
Snakebite said to the other sister, glancing at Fowler and Storm as he spoke. Can we step into the kitchen? Fowler gestured toward the door at the back of the store. He followed Storm through. Hands on the Formica counter, Storm examined a display of blue and red floral-patterned plates hung on the wall.
I want to thank you for bringing me here. I still resent the way you did it, but I can see now that you saved my life.
When Fowler didn't reply, Storm looked at him, and he nodded, not sure what she wanted him to say.
I stayed up half the night talking with Emily and Susanna. I explained where I came from, and they believed me and didn't pull any of that bad feelings, crap. I feel at home with them, at peace, in a way I never felt on my own world.
It took Fowler a moment to realize what she was saying.
You want to stay?
Yes.
But we can't. I have to keep going. He pressed his hand over the pocket that held the map.
Storm nodded.
I know you do. But I thought...
Fowler stammered. He'd thought they were destined to be together, that they were soulmates. Those words would sound foolish if he said them aloud.
Don't you want to know what's down there? Don't you feel like...
He searched for words. Like there's a big piece of you that's missing, that slides just out of your grasp every time you reach for it? He pulled the paratrooper out of his pocket, then the map, the photo, and slapped them all down on the kitchen table. The answers are down. Before day one, I did everything I could to point myself in that direction. And then I added a picture of you. Could the message be any clearer? We're supposed to go down there together. Storm went to the window, leaned against the frame.
Or you're supposed to go down there with Emily. Or Susanna.
It's you in the photo. I know it's you. Storm closed her eyes.
All I had in my pocket on day one was a loaded gun. No maps, no parachutes.
No picture of Fowler. She left that unsaid.
Then forget the things in my pocket. The answers are still down. You feel it, don't you?
Oh, I feel it.
Don't you want to know what it is?
No,
Storm finally said. How can you not... Storm raised her voice, spoke over him.
Because it's something horrible.
The emotion behind her words took Fowler by surprise, but he couldn't argue with her. If I could fall up, away from it, I would. Her words sparked images from his nightmares, of giant intestines and bleeding skies, and suddenly the darkening sky framed in the kitchen window seemed ominous, unknowable. Storm reached out, touched the side of his face. Her fingers felt cool and soft on his cheek. The only thing that really matters in life are people. If you have people you care about, you have everything you need.
I couldn't agree more.
He reached out, took her hand. That's why I want you to come with me. Storm didn't pull her hand back, only smiled.
I can't leave Emily and Susanna. I have family. Can you understand how much that means to me?
Then I'll stay here with you.
Storm laughed. You'd hate yourself if you stayed here, and me as well.
Fowler opened his mouth. To disagree, to tell her he'd rather be with her and never know, she gave his hand a squeeze, then let it go.
I'm going to see how the chair is coming.
The door swung shut. Fowler stared out the window, at black rain clouds in the distance. When he finally pushed open the kitchen door and paused on the other side, Storm and Emily were talking in low tones by the door, their heads together. When Storm saw him, she said,
Snakebite fixed the chair. We're heading back.
I'll walk with you. He swallowed, trying to loosen a lump in his throat as he took the chair from Snakebite and followed them out. As they walked, Fowler lost track of which was Storm and which Emily. And no matter how carefully he watched them, there was nothing that gave it away. One of them lifted her finger, pressed it to her upper lip, the other canted her head to one side, her arms folded. All were Storm's mannerisms. He wondered if he should say goodbye tonight and leave first thing in the morning. Whatever waited at the bottom could probably wait a few extra days, but staying longer would only make leaving more painful. A deafening bang made Fowler jump. Storm, or Emily, jolted violently to one side and dropped to the sidewalk, blood blooming just below her ear. The other Storm shrieked as three more quick bangs erupted, so loud they left Fowler's ears ringing.
Don't move, stay right where you are.
It was a man's voice. Fowler spun.
I said, don't move.
Two figures came at him, dressed in black, sheer black masks, covering everything but their eyes. One, his gun raised, hit Fowler in the face, just under his eye. Fowler staggered, would have fallen if the other hadn't grabbed him. He yanked Fowler's arms back. Four or five other figures fanned out around them as Storm shrieked. Two of the figures were restraining her. A big man dressed in military garb strode over to Storm, or Emily, pistol raised.
Be quiet or I'll shoot you right here.
The man turned toward Fowler.
Gotcha!
He sounded jubilant, like a child who's found a can of chocolate pudding.
You got who? Fowler asked.
Who do you think I am? Whoever it is, you're wrong, because I'm nobody. You just killed someone to grab nobody. The man stepped closer. He had a beefy face, a long nose.
You're a terrible actor, Peter. If the blackout virus got you, how did you know you could jump from one island to another? Instinct? You're going to show me where you hid.
There was a click, followed closely by an ungodly boom. The bottom of one of the figure's faces disappeared, replaced by bloody meat and bone. Another boom, and another figure dropped, twisting on the ground, clutching his ruined stomach. The remaining figures fanned out, keeping low, guns raised, leaving Fowler and Storm, God, he hoped it was Storm, alone in the open. Storm dropped to the pavement, crawled to her twin. Fowler followed. Fowler saw the flash of a muzzle out of the corner of his eye coming from the broken window of the store directly beside them. One of the figures in the street went down, hit him a thigh.
There!
One of the masked men pointed. His comrades sprinted to either side of the store where the gunshot had come from.
Faller squinted at the window, spotted a large shape that had to be Snakebite hanging back in the shadows. There was shouting in the distance, people alerted by the shotgun fire heading their way. Faller hoped they had guns. Pistol raised, one of the men in black made a run across the front of the store. "Look out!" Faller shouted. He saw Snakebite drop and roll as the gunman fired and kept firing until he was clear of the store. Two others turned and barged into the store, firing into the darkness. Two more shotgun blasts. Both men went down. Faller looked around, realized their ringleader, the man who'd called him Peter, was gone. A handful of locals were in the streets, heading their way. The shooters, still standing, fled down the street. Snakebite came flying through the door, sawed-off shotgun in hand, just in time to see the three figures duck between two buildings on the edge side of the street. Snakebite scanned the street for others, then lowered the gun as three locals pulled up short, surveying the carnage.
"My God, what happened?"
It was Stuart. Labored breathing was the only sound, as Snakebite stood, his arms dangling at his sides as if he didn't know what to do with them now. Storm was kneeling in a puddle of blood, cradling Emily's head, or maybe it was the other way around. The wound was a raw pit. Fuller quashed a cry of despair at the blood leaking down the side of her face. Glaring at one of the dead assassins lying nearby, Fuller crawled to the lifeless figure, reached under his chin, found the end of the mask, and yanked it up. The air emptied from Fuller's lungs. They stayed empty until black specks filled his vision, until he could no longer make out the face in front of him. Still, he couldn't inhale. He thought he was going to pass out and craved that oblivion. Snakebite yanked the mask off another corpse. That one, just like the first, looked like Faller.
"What's going on?" a woman cried. She was part of a gathering crowd, keeping its distance from the carnage.
Stuart marched right up, surveyed the corpse, then glared at Faller.
"You need to go back where you came from."
"Hey, they came after me.
If I ever lay eyes on you again, I swear I'll hang you from that light pole."
He pointed out the light pole, then looked at Storm or Emily.
"Who are you? Who is that?"
Faller braced himself, afraid to hear. The woman sobbed, took the lifeless hand of the other, and held it to her face.
"Please," Faller said, "tell me who you are."
Head down, her hair masking her face, she answered bitterly, angrily,
"I'm Emily."
She kissed the white knuckles, whispered,
"I'm Emily."
Paula sank to the pavement. A white-haired woman broke from the crowd, helped Emily up.
"I'll take you back to Susanna."
Arms linked, the woman led Emily away, her bare calf slipping free of the back of her dress with each step. Why couldn't it be Emily who was killed? It was an uncharitable thought, but Fowler couldn't help it. It could just as easily have been Emily. He and Storm had been pulled apart by whatever had happened to fuck up this world, and somehow, he'd found her again. All Emily seemed to have suffered was a scrape on her calf. As her calf appeared again, he saw it was a bad scrape, three or four ragged lines running to her ankle, plus a few scuffed red patches. Emily paused, as if she'd forgotten something. She said something to the old woman, turned, and approached Fowler. She held out her hand.
"I'm sorry for your loss."
Her eyes were red.
"Thank you."
Fowler took her hand. Her fingers were badly scraped, especially her fingertips. The skin was flayed at her fingertips, leaving red ovals. The wounds were beginning to scab over. They weren't the sort you'd get cleaning a rabbit or picking blackberries. More what you'd get if you were clinging to something, scratching to hang on. Fowler searched her eyes. He let his lips form the name Storm. She swallowed, nodded, squeezed his hand hard, and he understood.
"Don't give me away."
He nodded back. "Goodbye."
"Goodbye,"
she whispered. Chapter 15. The singularity hung suspended inside the containment chamber, in no particular hurry to give up its secrets.
Peter wished he had all the time in the world to peel away the layers of this mystery, but he didn't. He was like an archaeologist forced to use a backhoe loader to excavate a fragile site. Harry was hard at work on the most promising angle Peter had devised to convert the energy they harvested from the singularity into something usable. 50 spotlights were mounted on the factory wall, connected to fuel cells of varying design. It was like a contest to see which of the brilliant minds in the room could figure out how to light one first. Peter's small team buzzed around the factory floor, huddled in quiet conversations and corners, pecked at handheld computers, argued in front of dry erase boards. He wondered if any of them had confided in a spouse, a lover, a relative about what was down here. At least the feds hadn't gotten wind of it yet. It was so strange to Peter, so foreign, to have secrets. Before Isabella's death, what secrets did he have? None of any consequence. There were those Marvel superhero action figures he'd stolen from the local Walmart over the course of a couple of years. He'd never gotten caught. His parents never asked where a dirt poor kid like him got all those action figures. He was surprised how his memory went in a clear, unbroken line back to his childhood. He'd anticipated a clear division between the original Peter and him, duplicate Peter, but it was as if he were the exact same person. As if it were the duplicate Peter who died, not the original. A buzz rose at the far end of the floor. Peter turned to find Melissa heading toward him. Peter met her halfway. "What is going on with Ugo? I've left 3 messages in the past 2 days. I haven't heard from him since a few days after the funeral." Peter nodded, not sure what to say. "It's like instead of you two pulling together after Isabella died, it pushed you apart. Evidently, I'm on the outside now as well." "I'm not sure what to say. We had an argument. A couple of arguments, really. And the rift just kept growing until we're not speaking." He was blinking rapidly. Felt horrible telling his wife such an utter lie. "I'm pretty sure he's still working for the Department of Defense, out at Camp Peary. They must have him working on biological weapons. It's possible he hasn't gotten back to you because he's busy." "Can't you try to smooth things over with him?" Peter spread his hands. "I brought him $400 chocolates, and they use them as golf balls. What more can I do?" Melissa sighed. "I know. It just kills me. We're family. Isabella would be heartbroken." Peter wondered for the 100th time if there was some way to confess everything to Melissa. The weight of it was suffocating him. He couldn't remember the last time he'd been able to take a deep, full, easy breath. "Are you keeping up with the news?" Melissa asked. "The TV is on in the lab, but not down here. Why?" He was afraid to ask. "The EU has fallen." Peter dropped his head. "Shit." It wasn't unexpected, but somehow he'd thought they could hold out for a few more months. The thought of Iranian, Pakistani, Russian troops controlling England, France, Germany was terrifying. "You really think you can stop it with this?" Melissa gestured toward the containment chamber. "I wonder if it's gone too far." Peter shook his head. "Kathleen thinks it may not be too late. There'd be some hard negotiations about territory already conquered. The maps aren't going to be the same as before. But she's convinced the major players would be open to a ceasefire in exchange for unlimited energy, especially under the threat of being cut out of the deal if they don't comply."
"Peter!"
Harry screamed. Peter spun in the direction of the cry, found Harry near the wall, pointing up at a spotlight that had snapped on, painting a portion of the floor in stark white light. Another popped to bright life, then another. Within a minute, looking at the wall was like staring into the sun. If he mounted a million spotlights to the wall, Peter had no doubt the grid could light them all. Chapter 29. Snakebite opened his pantry, set a sack beneath it, and swept the entire contents into the sack.
No, that's too generous, Fowler said, waving his hands. I can't accept all that.
Snakebite turned his fierce eyes on Fowler. Even now, knowing Snakebite wasn't a threat, they unnerved him.
I'm coming with you.
What? Why?
Snakebite disappeared for a moment, returned, clutching a wallet. He dropped it on the table.
Here's what was in my pocket on day one. Take a look.
There was a laminated card with Snakebite's photo on it, some cash, a folded up piece of yellow paper, some plastic squares his mind insisted on calling credit cards, and, tucked in their own compartment, three photos of children. Two girls, one boy. All had Snakebite's black hair, his reddish complexion, his fierce eyes.
You ever see any of them on your world?
Snakebite asked. Fowler shook his head. I would remember if I had. Unless they, you know, were gone early. Fowler handed the photos back to him.
I never knew what to make of those pictures. Now I understand. You found your woman. I want to find my children.
Snakebite shrugged.
I don't belong here anyway. I've always sensed that. Will you help me make a parachute?
Sure.
Fowler was overjoyed at the thought of a traveling companion, especially one with a shotgun and deadly aim. He touched Snakebite's shoulder. Come on, we should probably be gone by dawn. Behind what had once been a restaurant, they found a courtyard with steel tables and chairs, sheltered by a fabric canopy that was perfect parachute material. They cut it down and headed back to Snakebite's shop. Snakebite was carrying his shotgun. Both kept an eye out for movement. I'm trying to understand how they got here and why they came, Fowler said as they walked. Snakebite glanced at the sky.
They must have come the same way as you. They're chasing you for some reason.
The one man who didn't look like me thought I was some guy named Peter.
Maybe they have your name wrong, but I bet you're the one they're after. You can move from one world to another, and so can they. I doubt that's a coincidence. Maybe they don't like that you're moving from place to place.
The man who called me Peter told me I should have stayed hidden, like he'd been looking for me even before I started falling. Then he said something about a blackout. And just before you fired your first shot, he was starting to say he wanted me to show him where I'd hidden something. I think it's a case of mistaken identity.
Or maybe your real name is Peter,
Snakebite said. The thought of that made Fowler's bones shiver. How would he know that?
Maybe he didn't forget.
The possibility struck Fowler like a brick. If it were true, that man would have all the answers. Chapter 30. Half a dozen shops from Snakebite's store. One shop had burned and been cleared away, leaving a gap like a missing tooth. Nothing but a cracked foundation hanging over the edge. Each hefting a heavy backpack, they stood in a silent row along the edge and looked out at the sky. Bystanders hung back on the sidewalk. Storm wasn't one of them. Fowler was relieved. They'd said goodbye. Seeing her again would only make jumping that much harder. After they'd finished Snakebite's parachute, Fowler had lain awake, his stomach in knots, wishing he could stay on this repressed little splinter of a world with Storm. Fowler turned to Snakebite.
Ready?
Snakebite nodded. On three, okay?
Fowler!
He turned toward her voice.
Storm?
She was dressed in her old outfit. Jeans and a white shirt. A pack strapped across her back. Susanna was with her, their eyes still wet with tears.
Is there room for one more in your parachute? She asked.
Fowler raced over, swept her into a fierce hug.
Really? You're really going with us?
I convinced her she should go, Susanna said. The more we talked, the more obvious it was that... She paused, searching for words. Her place was with you. Storm broke away from Fowler's embrace.
We'd better get going.
Susanna said Stuart is just dying to find you still here. Snakebite laughed gruffly.
Yeah, I'm shaking in my boots. Are we ready?
Susanna poked Fowler in the chest.
You take good care of her.
She looked at Snakebite.
You too.
They took their places on the edge of the world. This time, Snakebite counted to three. They jumped in unison. He gave Snakebite a few minutes to get accustomed to falling, then
He drifted over. "Landing lessons," he shouted. Snakebite nodded. Fowler set out to teach both of them everything he knew about navigating and landing. On the next world, they could fashion a parachute for Storm. Then they'd be set. Chapter 16. The William and Mary campus passed on Peter's left. Darkened, red brick buildings spread across a smooth green lawn. The campus was deserted, in the middle of what should have been fall semester. So many of those kids were out west now, on the front lines, or fighting in Southeast Asia, or North Africa, or dead. So many were dead. The press couldn't provide even a partially accurate estimate of how many Americans had been killed in the war. Millions was all anyone knew at this point. Millions. Pulling up their long driveway, he could see through the fence that the pool area was lit, the fountain spraying a plume of water into the sky. As the sun went down, their neighbors would see this decadent display of electricity from their dark houses as they sat reading books or playing board games by flashlight. He felt guilty enough that they had a generator and enough pull to be able to acquire fuel to run it. Flaunting it wasn't a great idea. Most people thought Peter's income paid most of their mortgage, but the truth was Melissa brought in more than he did. Peter took a salary, but he felt funny earning too much doing scientific research. Melissa's work was always in demand, especially the miniature golf courses. Disney World had one, and so did the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Melissa stepped onto the porch as he came up the walk. "We having a party or something?" Peter joked. He gave her a kiss. As they drew apart, he noticed something in her eyes, an uneasiness. "What is it?" Peter asked. "Come on in and have a drink, and I'll tell you." "I definitely don't like the sound of that." He followed her inside, through the high-ceilinged, marble-floored vestibule, down the hall and out onto the veranda that overlooked the pool, where Dahlia, their cook and housekeeper, had set three places for dinner. "I thought it was just us tonight," Peter said. "That's what I want to talk about, after you have a drink." Peter stopped in his tracks. "Why? Who's coming?" The expression on Melissa's face was answer enough. "He doesn't know you're going to be here. I told him you were staying at the lab." Peter's heart began to drum. Melissa swept strands of hair out of her face. "I'm sorry I lied. It was the only way I could think to get the two of you in the same room." She put her hands on her narrow hips, looked through the wide arched doorway into the hall. "He's family. Whatever's come between you two, you need to sort it out." The doorbell rang. Peter's first thought was to slip out the back while Melissa answered it, but he couldn't do that to her. He and Ugo would just have to tolerate each other's presence for one dinner. They could discuss neutral topics, music, fine chocolates. The sound of his booming baritone, the clipped Slavic accent, made Peter cringe. The voice grew louder as Melissa led him down the hall. "I should have called you weeks ago, but I've been..." When he saw Peter, he stopped in his tracks. "Ugo," Peter said, as amiably as he could manage. Ugo tried to pull his jacket back on, as Melissa took his elbow and all but dragged him toward the table. "Ugo, sit!" Reluctantly, Ugo allowed Melissa to shove him into a seat. She looked at Peter. "Sit, please." Peter took a seat at the opposite end of the table, with Melissa between them. "You two have been friends for 10 years. You really want to give that up because of an argument?" She looked from one of them to the other. Peter shrugged. "Sometimes people just drift apart." Muttering under his breath, Ugo reached across the table and poured himself a generous martini from a silver shaker. Peter stared off at the brass and silver fountain set in the center circle of their tri-level pool. "Remember the time you two city boys decided to go camping in the wilderness?" Melissa asked. "It was freezing out, and it started to rain, so you headed back toward the road in the dark and you got lost. You spent the night shivering under a tree, and in the morning it turned out you were 100 feet from a restroom." She looked at Ugo, then Peter. "Right?"
Peter tried to smile, but the corners of his mouth just wouldn't lift. Ugo was staring at his empty dish. The first night we all went out together, Peter traded shirts with you on the way to the bar because a bird pooped on yours. She waited for some sort of reaction. You don't throw away that sort of friendship. You just don't.
Peter mustered a weak nod.
You can't even look at each other. Melissa turned to Ugo. Peter says you're angry with him because he didn't make a public statement about you deserving to share the Nobel.
Ugo plucked a shrimp from an iced dish, popped it in his mouth. If that's what he says it's about, who am I to argue?
No words would come to Peter.